session number 3994, rule 3.
Three.
Establishment.
Well, B Company was consisted not of Somalis at all, but a tribe called Yaos, who came from Nyasaland, and they had been brought in years before on the basis that some outside race, uninfluenced by Somali or Islamic considerations, should be there as the ultimate resource in the event of disaffection. And they were charming people. They were very much of a negroid race. They had a very good sense of humour. They were good soldiers. They had their families with them. They lived in a separate fort. They had virtually no dealings with the Somalis. They were pagans, basically, and certainly not Muslims. And the Somalis looked down on them as being an inferior race. But then they looked down on pretty well everybody as being an inferior race. But the Yaos got on perfectly well. They lived a completely isolated life. They had nothing to do with Somalis, and the Somalis wouldn't have anything to do with them. But they were good soldiers. They were accepted by the Somalis as part of the show. And they were mounted in rather ancient Morris trucks at the beginning of mechanization. And they had a Nyasa-speaking officer, or Chinyanja-speaking officer, always as their company commander, who had probably served in, I think it was the 6th KAR they came from. They'd served limited time there. They served 2 or 3 years and then went back to Nyasaland, and a new draft came up. There was a constant turnover of them. Well, that was B Company in trucks. And then C Company was, Somalis on ponies. The Somali pony, a rather remarkable animal, very small, and would carry a man with all his equipment and 2 days' feed, everything that he could possibly need, for miles and miles and miles. I once, after the war had started locally, I wanted to know whether there was an Italian column in a certain place, and I had no means of finding out except sending a man on a horse. So I sent a man on a horse. It was a picked horse, so we agreed that, you know, we went over the whole lot of them. We said, well, let's make it that one. And I said, it's no use getting back here at midday tomorrow. You've got to be back before dawn if we're to take any effective action. So what I want you to do, I don't want to do anything else but get to whatever the name of the place was. If there are Italians there, come straight back and tell me. If you're satisfied there are no Italians there, come back and tell me. That's your task, but as quick as possible. And I can't remember the exact timing, but that wasn't until the late afternoon that he left. He was back before morning, and he'd done not less than 72 miles. Both of them perfectly fit. Well, the Somali pony, apart from being a very good polo pony as well, had a tremendous lot of virtues. He was never shod, never needed shoes. He could live on practically nothing and was watered once a day. And all this was produced a very tough, hardy little war horse. Well, the C Company, which I was lucky enough to command, had 120 soldiers, establishment of 120 soldiers and 140 ponies. So you can imagine there was no difficulty in playing polo, particularly as the Somalis, usually the senior Somali NCOs, played polo. If one was short of other players, they played and they thoroughly enjoyed it. So that was the establishment of A Company on camels, B Company on the Nyasas in trucks, and C Company on horses, ponies. There was also the Reservist Company, which was a remarkable gang of old men who were called up for training every year, and in fact were called up for the war and fought extremely well. Extremely well. They were covered with the medals of forgotten wars, and were great characters in their own way. They were all like sort of black Chelsea pensioners, and but they were very good soldiers, reared in the very ancient, very hard tradition, and they provided the fourth company, which, as I say, when war came, they fought and fought very well.
How did you keep in touch with these reservists before the war?
You didn't, virtually. Merely the word went out that next March the reservists should be in, and they all turned up. On the subject of communications, there was, right up till the evacuation in 1940, virtually no, except the incoming units, a couple of regiments, battalions of the Indian Army and the Black Watch and so on, they had their standard wireless equipment. But the otherwise, I mean, in Berar, which was my war station, I was entirely dependent on the civil postmaster, who was an Indian, for all communications with the outside world. I had no means of communication at all. And between troops, which might be on a front of 20 miles, it was a man on a horse or a man on a camel or a runner or a man in a passing truck. So you had no wireless set up at all, which, of course, in light of what happened in the war, was a remarkable way to, way to go on. I always remember the Indian postmaster, who was also the telegraphist at Berar Post Office when we'd been bombed one day. The moment the planes had gone away, he came rushing to me and said, "Oh, sir, please to tell Italians I am non-combatant. They are not to bomb me."
How was it that one company had camels and another ponies?
Well, it really went back to the days of fighting the Mad Mullah in the 1914-20, 21-22, where you needed the camel, which could cover enormous distances at a slower pace, but was far less dependent on water or grazing. You'd live on nothing at all, no water, for a relatively long time. So you could move a main body of a more heavy striking force by camel than you could by pony. You needed the ponies for speed and for operating in mountains, where the camels in mountainous or rocky going are incredibly slow. With their great big splashy feet, they in fact won't last very long over bad going, whereas ponies will rattle over the stones and rock in no time at all, and are very much more active, very much quicker. You've got much greater mobility. So it was a balance really between the rather ponderous camel and the rather quick, active little pony. And you've got the endurance of the camel company with the intense mobility of the pony.
Why was it that the pony company was out at Hargeisa?
Oh, because it was much better grazing, and much better grazing, and much better water, much better everything, and much more suitable. It was also more mountainous. It wasn't the pony company was not always at Hargeisa. The companies alternated, but the country there suited the ponies very much better than the camels, and Berar suited the camels very much better. At a later stage, when General Chaytor, or at least Colonel Chaytor, now General Chaytor, took over command, the Camel Corps was reorganized into still A, B, C, and D companies, but A and C companies were brought onto the same establishment of one pony troop and three camel troops. So they were both the same. The pony troop, again, to provide the mobility, the reconnaissance element, and the camels for the greater endurance. So that was A and C. I'm now talking of the years of 1938-39. A and C had one pony troop and three camel troops. And B Company remained the same, Nyasas. And D Company was mounted on anything that happened to be passing, such as a trade truck or anything else that could be spared. And ultimately, when the war started, we did have a very, very small, I think I had in C Company, my pony troop, three camel troops, and I think it was two or three light trucks for quicker reconnaissance. I also had a Model T Ford car, which I owned myself, and covered it in paint and threw red sand on its camouflage. It rumbled its way to the end of the campaign.
Where did you get the ponies from at Hargeisa?
Well, Hargeisa itself was a good breeding area. and there was a certain amount of pedigree, quite a lot of pedigree breeding around there, on the and the vast plains to the west produced literally herds of ponies, breeding not wild, but it was a good breed, pony breeding area. And then in the extreme east, a place called Erigavo, you've got the best ponies from Erigavo, the best lookers, the best, toughest. Wonderful, a wonderful breed of pony there. And if you went off and bought whatever was necessary every now and then, they're quite cheap. You didn't pay more than, if you paid £15 for a pony, you were going rather far. So it was a very economical form of transport.
Was there a stud at Hargeisa?
There was at one time, and in the very early 30s, and it was producing the most wonderful ponies, wonderful foals, and we had quite a few in the ranks of C Company. We had quite a few in the subsequent years, a few of the, some of the produce of the stud farm, which was run by the government. And very sadly, the treasury element of the government, the home government, insisted that they, in 1935, I think it was, that the stud farm must be closed down because it was running at a loss. Well, the economics of it were that its first year it had shown a heavy loss, which then had been expected. You can't sell yearlings in a place like that, in a country like that. The second year, the loss wasn't so bad. The third year, the loss was minimal. And the fourth year, it was bound to show a profit. But that logic didn't carry much weight with the treasury. And it was duly closed down, which was a tragedy, because it was producing a very, very high standard of pony. Absolute pleasure to look at. Great performance, too.
Can you describe the typical Somaliland pony?
Well, if you take a thoroughbred English hunter and reduce him in size by half to two-thirds, you've got the Somali pony, the best Somali pony. Naturally, you had, like any other breed, any native breed of ponies. The Somali pony is separate altogether. He's not an Arab. He's a tribe and a breed on his own. But you naturally got the bad conformation and rather ponies that you could fault very easily. But they were, as I said, take a very good-looking English thoroughbred hunter and shrink him a lot, and you've got the best of the Somali ponies. Wonderful temperament. They would have made wonderful children's ponies, but now the whole breed has deteriorated thanks to the motor car, and I doubt if there's a pony worth buying, that is.
In fact, you had thought of
In 1938, I was thinking of when my time to come home, to serve at home, would have been that I would have come home in 39 if the war hadn't happened. And I was thinking, and taking steps to bring home a Ceylon and two mares, with the intention of setting them up here to try and breed children's ponies, which I'm quite sure would have been a tremendous success, but of course the war put the tin hat on that one.
Did the Somali troops need much training in conjunction with their ponies, or were they natural horsemen?
No, they actually riding was the least difficulties. They certainly in those days they still rode quite a lot, rode their own ponies in their civilian life, and teaching them to ride was never a problem, and they were you might call somewhat dashing horsemen. The Somali is nothing if not impetuous, and they prefer to move at the gallop rather than the trot, but they were on the whole good horsemen, and not a lot of the Abyssinian bit, the horse's bit, is the cruelest thing you've ever seen. It's got immense leverage and spikes and things to stick into the horse's tongue. It's really a vicious implement. And the Somalis are, no, not very, not necessarily very polished hands, but they're far better hands and far more gentle with animals. They were, as a hard race in a hard country, they were hard on their ponies, but not cruel and willful.
Did they use their Abyssinian bit in the Somaliland Camel Corps?
No, nothing like it. There was the standard Camel Corps bit, which was a very, very mild, very mild portmouth bit, a very gentle bit, and it was very seldom that you had any. Somali ponies got such a good temperament, they didn't need any very severe bitting.
You say that teaching them to ride was one of the least of your problems. can you describe to me some of your more larger problems?
Well, actually, they were easy to train because there was a great willingness to learn, a great willingness to, at least not so much a willingness to learn because they thought they knew everything, but a willingness to conform and comply. And you never had any discipline was not really a problem, assuming that you handled them properly. If you handled them wrong, you would have trouble.
Did you ever have any examples of a commander handling them wrong?
Well, the one I've given before of the this one particular chap who had a rather a gift for getting on the getting people on the wrong side of him.
What had he actually done to cause this minor mutiny?
I think you could say that one of the contributory factors was that it came out that a man was deficient of a pull-through, pull-through for a rifle. A man deficient of a pull-through, he would be charged, as normally, with deficiency, being deficient of a pull-through, not a very serious offence. But this particular chap wanted to follow up and then charge the section commander for not having reported the absence of a pull-through in Private Mohammed, and then the troop sergeant for not having reported the lance corporal for not having reported the man. Well, it was heading for a collision inevitably. One of the things that helped a lot, I was lucky in having a year for, I'm not boasting, as I boast about it, but talking Somali was not a great problem to me. And a number of people who were brilliant, much better brains than I was, never made any progress at all in Somalia and relied absolutely totally on their interpreter, and some picked it up brilliantly in a very short time. I was neither brilliant nor unable, but I became an interpreter under the civil regulations, where I think I got shilling a month or something for that, and I didn't really find Somali Somali language was a real problem. I always used interpreters because, amongst other things, it gave you time to think. You were trying a case. You knew perfectly well what the man had said, but you let the interpreter say it again to just be quite certain and to weigh things up a little more.
How did you go about learning Somali?
Almost entirely by not formal lessons. There was virtually nobody who was capable of teaching you. There was a book which everybody was issued with, Kirk's Somali Grammar. A man called Kirk had written it in the 20s, I think, and it was a very well written book, but rather more erudite than I could cope with. I couldn't even understand some of his English, and it was a very helpful basis, and if you could master Kirk, the more simple bits of Kirk, you could then build very happily onto your vocabulary. And the Somalis were great fun. If you said something, you said it wrong. There was no blank stares of what's he talking about. You got your leg pulled and told how you should say it. And particularly if one was prepared to go along with them and laugh about it. And they were very good at teaching one.
Were the interpreters any help in teaching the Somali?
Yes, this particular man, Haji Deria, jogging along on one's pony, one would say, Deria, the chap said something just now. Why did he put it like that, and why didn't he put it like this? And he was very, very good. He also had a tremendous help to me, because he had what I think is very lacking, and the Somalis particularly talk very quickly. He was quite capable of breaking a word down into its syllables. Well, I would say, no, take it quietly, Haji. It means this is what you are to say. And he would be capable of saying, wa-ha-ta-ra-ha. Well, if you've got a chap like that, of course, you could learn 10 times faster than a chap who just kept on saying, what you say is wa-ha-ta-ra-ha. Well, before you could, to break it down into the wa ha ta ra da. Simplicity itself.
And how long did it take you to become reasonably proficient in Somali?
Well, I would think that I wasn't really I was never very good, but I could get by for all practical purposes without an interpreter. And it took me 18 months, 2 years.
You told me that you passed as a civil interpreter. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, there was only the one exam.
What did that consist of?
A written, according to Kirk's, as far as I remember, there was a short written paper using Kirk's use of Roman letters. That was fairly simple because it had to be, the language itself being unwritten. And then there was a fairly lengthy interview with the district commissioner, the senior district commissioner, and a Somali assessor, and a Somali civil assessor, and they chatted you up. You were then asked to give orders, or not shout orders, but I mean give detailed orders about, say, somebody leaving for Berbera and what you wanted them to take with you. And that went on for about an hour, and then you passed off home. You passed and had gin. Not a very taxing exam.
Did you find your Somali NCOs helpful?
Very, very. The very loyal. I can't remember any instance where one felt I could brain that chap, either because he's made such a mess of things or because he's being willfully stupid or willfully obstructive. I can't remember one case. They the best example I can give of the capacity of a Somali soldier, in C Company, I had a very remarkable Company Sergeant Major, Company Sergeant Major Barry Goulade, who was excessively smart and loyal to a degree. The other soldiers all called him Barry 1-2, and he did everything by numbers. That when the evacuation took place in 1940, everything had been going, as far as I could tell, reasonably well. I was quite happy about it. Not happy about it, but it was all going all right. I then received a message that I was to disband my company and disperse them to the bush, to their homes, and that the British officers were to proceed to Berbera for embarkation. Now, as you can imagine, this was a pretty good blow to me, and the soldiers were certainly the last thing they were expecting. But I gave orders for the company to be dispersed, to be the animals to be tethered under trees, and the company to meet me under a big tree, to be told this sad news. And I said to, I said to the Sergeant Major, who was a totally untutored savage, I mean, he couldn't read or write, or a globe was, there's nothing, he wouldn't have known what it was for, or a map. And I said to him, I told him the truth. He looked exactly as I'd hit him in the face with a stick. And there was a short pause, and he said, but, Sir, what about England? Is England all right? So I said, yes, perfectly. So he said, well, then what are we worrying about? There was ruin staring him in the face. His own family were in the enemy's hands by that time, all his stock being looted, the whole of his world collapsing around him, and a future, bleak to say the least. And all he could think of was, is England all right? Well, if that's all right, if that's so, well, then what are we worrying about?
What were relations like then between yourself and the Somalis, and between the European officers and the Somalis?
On the whole, the fact that the Somali was a very quick brain, the fact that the Somali was very far from the slave mentality, and I say that without any disrespect to the more negroid races of the South, that they a proud race, the fact that they had a very good sense of humour, all helped to keep a very happy balance between officer and man. And in fact, the for example, if one was on the rifle range firing the annual classification requirement, chatting to either the corporal beside you operating the flare, the danger flag, or to the detail of men waiting to fire, and there was never any difficulty or silence or awkwardness. They were just very easy to get along with. They're very willing. I mean, there was no the great readiness to help and pitch in. They were very pleasant people to deal with.
Did their independence ever cause any problems from a military point of view?
Oh yes, the in the more mundane things like mounted drill on ponies, given half a chance, they'd conduct the whole thing at a gallop. And I always remember the new commanding officer, Colonel Chater, now General Chater, for whom I have the deepest respect, riding up to me when one of these performances was going on a wild open bit of bush, open bit of scrub, and my four troops were tearing about all over the place doing mounted drill by themselves. And I said, he said, ask me some question. I said, sir, shall I stop it? And he said, in a very calm, controlled voice, can you?
Were there any other ways in which the independence posed problems?
Well, in a local action, they became... I had one particular occasion where we'd been in pursuit of a raiding party of Italian Somaliland-based tribesmen who'd cleared off with an awful lot of cattle and sheep, with camels. And the news came in and off I went. And we caught up with them in the end. And then I'd entirely, for all practical purposes, lost control of the situation. If I'd given any orders, they wouldn't have been heard by anybody. The Somalis were just very effectively racing after anybody they saw and rounding them up, pursuing anybody, the enemy, and shooting them, and rounding up the stock. But they were completely out of human control. This was the life, I don't think one would have gotten his sail. And fortunately, it wasn't. We had enough soldiers to make sure the situation was all right, and I had three casualties, and there wasn't anybody left moving.
Did their NCOs manage to keep sufficient control over?
No, they were probably as bad as anybody else.
In general, did you find that NCOs managed to keep control over their troops?
Yes. On the whole, the thing one had to look out for was tribal prejudice. That the tribal balance of the Camel Corps was always very carefully kept. That you never allowed one tribe to gain such a dominance that tribe's interests could possibly be said to be paramount over anybody else's. But there was tribal balance was the thing that one had to keep an eye on.
Which tribes did you recruit from?
You try to recruit from everybody all over the country, so that there was no part of the country that was.